In this case, my client was denied proper evaluation by the jury of his testimony, which explained his activities in an innocent light because of errors made by the interpreter, the prosecutor, the judge, and maybe myself. Why was he denied that right? It's very simply. His testimony was he was going to meet the truck so he could help take the truck someplace so it can be repaired. When he testified, his testimony about the truck's condition was translated initially by the interpreter as it was broken down, which would mean not functioning, not moving. The prosecutor picked up on that and cross-examined him and said, well, you're a damn liar. You have to know it's not broken down because the truck's moving. The interpreter recognized that he made a mistake and on his own told the judge in a sidebar, Your Honor, with respect to the translation, the expression that's being used in Spanish for the truck being broken down is really a very general translation. But just for the record, that doesn't necessarily mean that the truck doesn't work, that there's a failure with it in some sort of way. The interpreter, the word that I used, Your Honor, that the truck was broken down, basically what I mean is something was broken down within the truck. And what I asked for, essentially, was the jury be told that the interpreter said that what was said by my client didn't mean that the truck was non-functional. The prosecutor, if you look at page 21 of my brief, initially recognized the correctness of my position. They say sometimes that there's truth in initial statements, dying declarations, special expressions, people recognize. The interpreter said, Yes, Your Honor, with respect to the translation, the expression that's being used in Spanish for the truck being broken down is really a very general translation. But just for the record, that doesn't necessarily mean the truck doesn't work, and there's a failure with it of some sort. Mr. Fullerton, who is the prosecutor, I think, Judge, I'd be happy if you just informed the jury that the interpreter was told us that there's a better translation. But then he backed off that. He didn't stay with what he should have stayed, which he was obligated to stay with. And then there was the cross-examination, which is set out on page 19, where the prosecutor, in essence, is saying that my client is a liar because he says it's broken down.
Could you correct that on redirect, Mr. Cohen?
Did I? A little bit. Yes, we did. But that doesn't have the import, because what it looks like is I'm caught with my pants down and now I'm going to change it. You're now changing your testimony after you've been caught. The defendant wasn't changing his testimony. It was simply that the interpreter gave a different version.
So, and redirect couldn't explain that?
Couldn't explain it with the same position in force as the simple, honest response of the judge saying, Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the interpreter has told us this. And read what the interpreter said. Because otherwise it just looks like the defendant is running away from being caught.
Well, we can't have interpreters testify. We can only have them... we can have new questions posed and get a correct interpretation, right?
We can't have call them to the stand.
We don't have to call them to the stand. All we need to have the judge say is the interpreter advised us when he interpreted this matter as broken down. What the defendant said was a Spanish term which could mean broken down.
Was there a suggestion that maybe a new question should be put to the defendant to explain it?
Any question put to the defendant couldn't resolve it, because it would look like the defendant was changing what he said. The defendant never changed what he said. It's that the interpreter interpreted it one way when another way was available.
What did the defendant say?
Well, I don't know. I don't speak Spanish.
No, I mean, what did the interpreter say the defendant said in response to the question of broken down?
The interpreter said the defendant used a word which could mean broken down, or could mean something is broken in the truck. It's the same word. The defendant used the same word. All right, I'll check it again. That's okay.
And so it's not the defendant changed, and to have the defendant now say what I meant was, that's the only way the defendant could have done it, is meaning the defendant's changing his testimony. The defendant's not going to say what I meant was, the defendant's saying the same thing. The second crucial way, and I see my time is up, but may I have another minute or two? The second crucial way is that prior to trial, let me go. One of the issues in trial is whether notes which were allegedly found in the defendant's wallets were found in the defendant's wallet. Defendant testified they were not found in his wallet. I cross-examined the officer who had all the wallets there, and I made it potentially very clear that he didn't keep track of what came from where. He says, I didn't mix it up, but you know, I didn't know this or that wallet. Prior to trial, the prosecutor realized that the card for attorney Chavez was in my client's wallet at this point in the occurrence, and they thought that might be a problem, so they called the attorney for Mr. Chavez and said, this wallet's here, is this going to cause a conflict? And he said, no. They never called me. They recognized there was a problem. They never notified me that this card was there. And when I started out by saying there was an error, it may have been an error of mine, my problem was I accepted what the prosecution had told me earlier in trial. They had given me a list of what was supposedly in my wallet. You know, this is the exhibits that are in the wallet. Well, I know the prosecutor's office in this district, you to be very honest and above board, is very complete. And when he told me that, I accepted it. I should have checked it. But I accepted that if there was something else in there, they would have told me when they told me that these things are there. They clearly should have corrected it when all this came out, and they should have told me beforehand.
All right, let's go.
Okay. May I have another minute
for a rebuttal?
Because I'm an old war horse.
All right, Mr. Cohn.
Okay. The other thing which I probably don't expect this court to do much with is the argument of standing. But I think there needs to be something done when there is outrageous government conduct, and what they do is essentially bribe the guy who's first seized by giving him a deal. This deal fell apart, gave him a deal, and so nobody else can raise it. And the government could get away with outrageous government contract. The rule of standing in America has changed by the U.S. Supreme Court as the need of society needs the rule of standing to change.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Cohn. Mr. Maksik?
May it please the Honorable Court, I'm Ralph Maksik for Mr. Chavez, the appellant. In a criminal case, you are usually handed or dealt cards, and they are what they are, but in this case I never expected to be dealt a hand of cards with my card in someone else's wallet. This was completely unexpected. It was pure serendipity that I had discovered the card, my business card, in Mr. Gonzalez's wallet. There was a group exhibit admitted into this case. There were a number of documents, papers found on Mr. Gonzalez. Those were had been removed from the wallet, and that wallet went into evidence, and that group exhibit went into evidence separately. As I said, it was pure serendipity that it was discovered. It's true that the United States attorneys, when they discovered that card, the offending card in this case, came to my office the night before on the eve of trial and said, we've discovered this card. Is there a conflict between you and the other person? And, of course, I said, no, there wasn't, and let's move on. Never anticipating that that card would now provide that very important link. In a case where I would respectfully argue to the court there was a paucity or a lack of evidence against Mr. Chavez, the appellant in this case. My point is here that this card, really supplied, if you will, and I hate to use the cliche, it really was a missing link. It showed there was no connection between Mr. Chavez and the other co-defendants that he was on trial with. This card says, found in the wallet of Gonzalez, it says, Mr. Metchik is the, I think a jury can reasonably understand this, Mr. Metchik might be the consigliere of the drug ring, or he might be the hired mouthpiece of this particular drug ring. So now we have, if you will, the attorney, the advocate, now acting not only on behalf of his client, but the other people who are also defendants in this case. Again, as I said, there was a real lack of evidence in this case. There was substantial impeachment of this case with the primary prosecution witness. So here you have a situation where you have extrajudicial evidence that Mr. Chavez could not rebut. There's nothing that we could say. We thought the case is going in well, actually, because you have a lack of evidence against them, because you have substantial...
The jury could just as easily have thought that the government got the contents of these wallets mixed up, didn't they? There's no real indication that they would have assumed that you were the kingpin of this group, or as you suggest.
Well, I think that...
I mean, that's a speculation.
It is conjecture, but in a close case, Your Honor, when someone is in prison, I don't think we can really conjecture. We can't say that this was really harmless error. I don't know. First of all, this jury had deliberated over a period of 3 days. And again, the evidence in this case linking Mr. Chavez to the conspiracy was extraordinarily weak, extraordinarily thin. And I think that may just have been the thing that put this over the top. Her Honor, Judge Bucklow, the district court judge in the case, said there was, in fact, an inability to confront the evidence. She even said this was, in fact, wrong, that Mr. Chavez could not confront the evidence against him. It was a deprivation of his Sixth Amendment rights. Yeah, I respectfully submit to you that it was a serious, serious matter that the jury did, in fact, consider, and Mr. Chavez could not do a thing about it.
Now, is it your position, Mr. Metchik, that this is likely a mistake, that the card was in your client's wallet, and then somehow, in examining these wallets, it found its way into Mr. Chavez's?
Judge Flom, I can't really answer that question in all candor.
Yeah.
I don't think there was any commingling in this case. There was no evidence, as far as I can recall, by the agents who investigated this case, where they took Mr. Chavez's belongings after his arrest and then commingled it with the others. I think that they had established a pretty good chain of custody. I think the agents are very, very careful when they see something documents, objects, that they are going to, of course, inventory those objects and establish a proper chain of custody.
There had been a card from a restaurant that was affiliated with one defendant and found in the wallet of another, not an attorney, and I appreciate the attorney's significance may carry a greater weight. Let's say it's a family member, it's a family restaurant of one defendant, or he's related, and it's found in the wallet of another. Is that at all something that you would be concerned about?
I would be concerned, but not as greatly concerned as I am about this. I think that the hypothetical that you posed to me, Judge Flom, is more innocuous. Finding a restaurant, people eat in restaurants, but here you have a criminal. I'm sorry, people eat in restaurants. I think it's not uncommon to have a card of a restaurant or any other establishment. But when you have counsel who happens to be defending the case, and I think the jurors are not ignorant. They know here is a criminal defense lawyer, and now, by pure serendipity, his card happens to appear in someone else's, well, then I think they can draw that connection. I think they can now zero in on that, and I think the impact is just too great, unlike the hypothetical where you just have a restaurant card. I think that's innocuous. This is far different. Here you have the advocate for the defendant who now claims at trial, I don't even know my co-defendant.
What if the counsel had given it to a co-defendant? I mean, the counsel for A... and given it to B. Does that mean it should never be entered in evidence?
It might be.
I'm not suggesting that occurred here, but let's just pose that.
But that might be, well, even if we pose it, that might be, we might be able to rebut that. There might be an explanation. The defendant can explain. So another witness can explain. Here it is already in the jury's hands, and he is effectively muted. He can't do anything about it. He can't confront this damning piece of evidence. And in this case, it was indeed a damning piece of evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Mandel?
Good morning. Your Honors, the point that I wanted to bring out is that my client's Jaime Rodriguez was found guilty by his association with the other defendants. The evidence against him was extremely slight. The other three defendants, Gonzalez was convicted by his telephone conversations. The driver, Perez, was stopped when the contraband was found in his truck. And Chavez was, there was testimony about his bribing somebody to get the garage where the stuff could be unloaded. Rodriguez, however, was convicted only by the grand jury testimony of Perez, which was allowed in when Perez refused to testify at trial. If you look at my brief, page 38, Judge Buchloe said, I'm certainly giving Perez's testimony regarding it with healthy skepticism. Seems to me that that was the only evidence that convicted Rodriguez. Also, Rodriguez was lumped together with Gonzalez. Gonzalez played a far greater role in this. He was the one that apparently had set everything up. When Perez was stopped and was cooperating with the police, he had several telephone conversations that were taped. He told Perez, "The way you'll recognize me is by the baseball shirt that I'm wearing." But the one thing was, Jaime Rodriguez was wearing the baseball shirt. You see also on page 38, the confusion lasted in Judge Buchloe's mind. She said at the sentencing, "After all, he's the one whose shirt is identified." Gonzalez, having given that to, in case something happened or was being taped, so that he wouldn't be identified in the baseball shirt. My next point that I want to deal with, Your Honors, is the sentencing. The safety valve, which my client, after the jury found him guilty, went to the U.S. attorney, had qualified on the other 4 points required, the only one having have to tell the government everything he knows truthfully. The government refused to listen to him, saying that that he could not deny his guilt and be truthful with him. We then took that before Judge Buchloe, had a hearing where he testified that, in fact, he didn't know. Judge Buchloe said, essentially, that if he was guilty and the jury found him guilty, leaving out the possibility that because the jury found him guilty because of the ostrich instruction, that even though he didn't know, he should have known. His testimony, therefore, would be truthful to the government, qualifying him for a 2-point reduction under the safety valve. And finally, the minimal and minor. When you look at my client's role in this matter, it's considerably less than any other person. My experience over 30 years in dealing with these, you look at the money. That's the people who are involved. Gonzalez, he had cars to bring, cars to provide for the stuff to be carried. Perez, the driver, had the tractor trailer. He'd been paid money. Okay. And, of course, Chavez had the money to pay for the garage or the warehouse. My client didn't have 20 cents in his pocket. My client's role in this matter was considerably less than any other person, and yet he was punished severely. Even though he maintained his innocence, he was not given the 2-point reduction for the safety valve, and he was not given a reduction, any reduction, as to a minor or minimal role.
Thank you, Mr. Mando. Mr. Banker?
May it please the court. This is really a case as far as the obstruction issue of first impression, I found no cases in any of the circuits like the facts here. What makes it unique is that the alleged perjury that was supposed to have led to the obstruction occurred in the trial of the co-defendant, not in Mr. Pettis' own hearings, whether they be the plea guilty or sentencing or discussions with a probation officer regarding the pre-sentence report. The trial attorney in the case at sentencing said something that I thought was appropriate. In his objections, he said the government is creating obstruction of justice here, and it's just not fair. The government knew months ago, prior to the trial of the co-defendant, that Mr. Pettis no longer wanted to cooperate. They filed a motion to revoke his plea agreement. They knew he no longer wanted to cooperate. He didn't want to go to trial. He didn't want to testify against any of the co-defendants. They knew about the fact that his family had allegedly been threatened, and he had been threatened by a co-defendant. They knew about some of the psychological issues that were going on with him. But they compelled his testimony because, as good trial lawyers, they knew that they had sworn grand jury testimony that was compelling, that was concise, that was credible. And they knew that they could use that grand jury testimony to impeach him in front of that jury, and it would work. If they didn't think it was going to work, they wouldn't have called him. And it helped make their case and got their conviction. Yet, when they argue at sentencing that the testimony was material as to one of the elements of perjury, that it had materiality, saying that it could have led to a verdict of not guilty, that it's possible that could have happened, a different verdict, they're giving us doublespeak. They have to make a choice here. They called the witness. They compelled him to testify because they knew it was going to work. I could see where if Mr. Pettis had outright denied it, had said to the jury, they're coercing me to testify against coercing my testimony at the grand jury, and they're just outright lying, and I deny the whole thing. He didn't do that. He came in here and just said, I don't remember. I don't remember if I testified to that at the grand jury. I remember being in the grand jury, but I don't remember if I testified to that or not. He didn't negate it. He didn't deny it. He didn't blame the government in front of the jury. It was effective for the prosecution in this case, and the irony is that if Mr. Pettis would not have cooperated to the extent he did by testifying at the grand jury and having that sworn testimony as ammunition for the government, we wouldn't be here today because they would not have called him to the witness stand. It's inconsistent to call him, to compel him, to use him, and use that grand jury testimony, knowing that they can use it to get a conviction, and then later on saying, "Oh, it was material because it could have possibly affected the jury in a different verdict," which is supporting their theory of perjury. I submit to the court that it was not material, and therefore it's not perjury, and therefore it's not obstruction. Also, I'd like to point out to the court, on the issue of the 1998 amendment to 3C1.1 in the guidelines that included the use of closely related offenses in the obstruction of justice provision, the commentary states, as I stated in the brief, this reflects the desire of the body to include any attempt of the defendant to avoid responsibility for his own conduct in testifying at another's trial. Mr. Pettis never negated his own conduct. He always said, I was guilty. He said it from the very beginning when he began to cooperate through the end until he got scared. As far as the safety valve provision, the government agrees that safety valve provision doesn't include the need to testify at a co-defendant's trial. If that were the case, safety valve, the provision would be ineffective because the defendant wouldn't want to debrief thinking that what he says to the government is later going to be subject to being called as a witness and testifying against a co-defendant. That's established. The provision basically says the defendant has to truthfully provide all information and evidence concerning the offense, which Mr. Pettis did. The government even acknowledged that in their plea agreement, the written plea agreement that was later revoked. They gave him credit for the safety valve. That was part of their agreement, that they recommended that he get safety valve.
Now the government is relying on Judge Plum's opinion, recent opinion on safety valve in this argument. What's your response to that?
I think you might be citing the was that the Ramirez case?
Yes. Ramuno.
I'm not sure which case you're referring to.
Ramuno, 133 F 3rd, 476.
I can't. I don't have that in my reply brief, and I don't know if I can comment on that right now. I would like, if I could, just to point out the court's ruling in the Ninth Circuit's ruling in Shrestha, where in that case the defendant had began to debrief, and he debriefed, and then later on in his own trial he recanted. That analysis was, well, the court felt like after it looked at what he said in his initial debriefing that it was true. He talked about co-defendants. He talked about his own guilt. And that court then said, even though he came in trial and recanted, he should still get the safety valve.
We haven't gone that far yet.
Okay.
I mean, no, I appreciate that. You're accurately reflecting the Ninth Circuit. We just haven't.
Okay.
You're urging us to adopt that, obviously.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm asking you to consider that as an option here. Shrestha, in this case, Mr. Pettis never recanted his own testimony. He just said that the co-defendants weren't. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. No, finish your thought. Finish your thought. I just wanted to remind you the time expired.
Now, as far as the acceptance of responsibility question is concerned, the court was. If you recall in the testimony or from the transcript, the court didn't think it could give acceptance and obstruction. If there was an obstruction finding, she couldn't give acceptance. We know that to be different, and this circuit has held that in extraordinary cases you can have them both together. And in this case, I would submit to the court there is an extraordinary case. Because he always accepted responsibility, he cooperated to the point that one of the officers said 90% of their case was made by Mr. Pettis.
Thank you, Mr. Banker. Mr. Shaw.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Manish Shaw, and I represent the United States. With respect to the issue of the interpreter, the defendant Gonzalez was never denied any right to testify, and his testimony was clarified on redirect. And it certainly would have been more inappropriate for the judge to have interjected into the proceedings what the interpreter had said, as opposed to letting the jury hear the testimony and evaluate what the defendant's testimony was. On redirect, when asked the question, essentially, what did you mean by truck being broken down? The defendant said, I thought the gears were broken, the gears were dropping, I thought something was wrong with the transmission. The defendant was given the opportunity to explain what his version of events was, and there was really nothing for the judge to do otherwise. The interpreter himself said that there was no inaccuracy in the translation. The interpreter said the words he chose, or the words he heard in Spanish, have many shades of meaning. And as the district court found...
Did the government rely on this inconsistency based on the translation later on in the trial?
No, the government did not. The government made no use of the defendant's testimony about broken down in argument, other than to point out that any kind of damage to the truck, whether it be totally inoperable or gears dropping and a problem with the transmission, any kind of problem with the truck is implausible because defendant Gonzalez never, in any of the recorded conversations, mentioned problems with the truck. So the government did make use of, in fact, what Gonzalez said, that there was a problem with the truck. The government did not make use of a theory that Gonzalez believed the truck was totally inoperable. And when the government was cross-examining Mr. Gonzalez, the answers that Mr. Gonzalez gave were answers of, I don't know, I don't understand what you're talking about. How could I know? The truck was already there by the time I got there. So Mr. Gonzalez's answers to the questions posed by the government really also clarify what he believed was happening and show that the government was not actually all that successful in painting him as a liar for thinking the truck was totally inoperable. There's really no reason for the judge to have done anything other than let the jury decide the question. And the English phrase, broken down, can equally be defined as a problem with the truck. English is susceptible to the same shades of meaning that the Spanish term is as well, and there's nothing for the judge to have done in this case. With respect to the wallet...
The judge could have permitted a presentment of a new question, couldn't she, Mr. Shaw?
And the judge did exactly that, on redirect.
On redirect, yes. On redirect. But I mean, at the time of being notified, I understand, I tried to make that redirect point myself, but at the time it was pointed out, further examination.
That's correct, Your Honor. At the time, the problem was, in the interpreter's view, the problem was pointed out, I believe it was after cross-examination. So the next phase
would have had a return to cross to straighten it out, I guess. She thought it would be better to be done on redirect.
The judge's ruling was people can ask a clarifying question. She didn't say it has to be done on redirect. She said anyone can ask a clarifying question. And Mr. Cohn brought up the fact that the government agreed at first that maybe a stipulation could be drafted or something. And as the parties were discussing that, it became clear that it really would make it more confusing to get into what the interpreter was saying and instruct the jury in a sort of separate manner than to just let a clarifying question be asked. So it was, in fact, the safer course to let a question be asked and let the testimony come in. With respect to the wallet, I think it's important to keep in mind that the exhibits listed and provided to defense were the exhibits that the government intended to introduce at trial and make use of, the notes recovered from Mr. Gonzalez's wallet. When chain of custody and possible impeachment of the contents of the wallet became an issue at trial, the government decided to introduce the wallet itself as a separate exhibit. The government did not conceal the contents of the wallet. The government did not list certain exhibits from the wallet and hide the fact that there were other things in the wallet. The government had really never intended to introduce the wallet in the first place until it became an issue in the middle of trial, and the wallet was available. Anyone could have looked at it, and it was admitted without objection. And the defense counsel was able to ask the questions about whether there was a mix-up or not a mix-up. With respect to the Sixth Amendment claim, the card does not actually, on its face, provide a link between defendant Chavez and defendant Gonzalez. Remember, it's not defendant Chavez's card that's in the wallet. It's counsel's card. And no use was made of this business card. It was never argued to the jury, look at that wallet when you get back in the jury room because there's a business card in there, and that will tell you everything you need to know about this conspiracy. That was not the government's argument. In fact, the government's argument with respect to Defendant Chavez was not that he had a prior relationship with Defendant Gonzalez. The argument was Defendant Chavez had a brother, Ramon, who was present on the scene, and it was through his brother, Ramon, that he became involved in this conspiracy. It was not an argument of the government that there was a link between Chavez and Gonzalez that this business card cemented. And it was really, we don't know whether the jury made any use of this business card.
Was everything found in all wallets that went to the jury sent? In other words, were all those intact? Or were there anything withdrawn from any wallet that didn't go to the jury? What I'm driving at is, any removal of anything, selectively or whatever. I'm not suggesting without the knowledge of one side or the other.
The belongings of the defendants that were, first of all exhibits that were admitted into evidence were sent back to the jury. The wallet of Defendant Gonzalez was sent back to the jury. A separate group exhibit composed of papers found in Defendant Gonzalez's wallet was also sent to the jury. Those were culled from the wallet and created as a separate exhibit, a collection of papers. That was sent to the jury.
Now, why was that done?
That was done because prior to trial and in the government's preparation of trial, the government intended only to introduce those pieces of paper.
Exactly. So, I appreciate why that collection was made and presented. Why then were the wallet sent back?
The wallet was sent back because the wallet was in evidence. The wallet was admitted as an exhibit. It was admitted into evidence without objection.
And what was the purpose of that?
The purpose was to show the chain of custody for the papers that were recovered from the wallet, and also use was made of the wallet because Defendant Gonzalez's driver's license was in the wallet. And the driver's license was shown, published to the jury, to show that this was Gonzalez's wallet. And then the next exhibit, these pieces of paper, the agent testified, were recovered from this wallet. So the government argued in closing that these papers were Defendant Gonzalez, and they were drug notes, drug ledgers.
They were what? Drug ledgers?
Drug ledgers, drug notes. They were showing arithmetic that added up to about 127. This case involved about 130 kilos of cocaine. There was a notation of one for the driver, which the government argued was...
Now, the government, prior to trial, noted this, the business card, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And was concerned enough to want to inform counsel of that.
Correct. When
could I draw from that, then the government felt that it was a little different than just a another business card. In other words, that it had a weight, let's say, or an importance that you wanted to highlight to defense counsel.
The weight and the importance that the government attributed to the business card was an ethical one.
Was what?
An ethical one. Was there a conflict of interest among defense counsel and defendants that should be inquired into? Is there a problem here with respect to a conflict? It was not, this provides the missing link that we didn't notice and we're going to use this at trial. That's not what the government did. The government saw the card and thought, we might have a problem, there might be an ethical issue here. Let's make an appropriate inquiry. Call Mr. Metchik because it's his card and another defendant. Is there a conflict? The representation is made. There is no conflict. And they go back to their trial prep. So that was the only significance that the government placed on the card. And again, no use was made of this business card at trial. And so we don't know whether the jury placed any significance on it at all. And I would also note that in Judge Bucklow's view, this was not a thin case against Defendant Chavez. While the government argues that there was no Sixth Amendment violation, Judge Bucklow also did the harmless error analysis and found that the business card would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Mr. Rodriguez has argued, it sounded to me during oral argument, a sufficiency of the evidence argument that he was convicted on thin evidence. That's not an argument he's raised in his brief. What he has argued is that he was entitled to the safety valve. The district court thought otherwise because the district court made a finding that he wasn't telling the truth about his involvement in the offense. And that is a classic reason to deny a defendant the safety valve. And it is the district court's judgment and it is left to the district court's discretion to make that finding.
Proper was not adequate. Is that what you're saying?
He also
proper to the government was not adequate.
The government did not agree that his proper was adequate, and he then testified at his sentencing hearing in line with the proper that he gave to the government. There was no, the government did not take the position that he said something in a proper and then lied on the witness stand at his sentencing hearing. He was consistent in what he said in the proper and what he testified to, but it was just false, and that is the problem. For Mr. Rodriguez in getting the safety valve. And the government did not refuse to listen. The government set up a proper, listened to what he had to say, took the position that it was false, and left it to the district court to make that determination. And again, with the other sentencing issue for Mr. Rodriguez, the minimal minor role, again, a fact-specific determination made by the district court that he was an integral member of this conspiracy. He's attending the meetings. There is testimony that he discussed taking Defendant Perez to the warehouse, that Mr. Rodriguez is the one who said that Defendant Gonzalez would go get the tools to open the trap compartment, and that Defendant Rodriguez was driving the minivan that was going into this warehouse that, by all logical inferences, was going to be the load car that was going to receive 130 kilos of cocaine. There's really no reason to think that Defendant Rodriguez is not an integral member of this conspiracy. And the district court's finding that he was not a minor or minimal participant was certainly not clearly erroneous. Defendant Perez has raised sentencing issues as well. And his obstruction, it's important to note that the district court found that when Defendant Perez said, "I don't remember," it was not a failing of his memory. He was affirmatively lying. He was actively attempting to impede the government's case against the co-defendants. And that amounted to obstruction of justice. The government called him to the witness stand, and while he did not have a cooperation agreement at that point that required him to testify, government certainly did not know that he would get up on the witness stand and lie. He was called as a witness. He was sworn to tell the truth. And when he started lying, the government had to use the sworn grand jury testimony in its case. But his own conduct was being negated by his testimony because he was saying he did not remember the conversations with his co-defendants, the recorded telephone calls, the meetings at the McDonald's at the Des Plaines Oasis. He did not remember driving the truck to the warehouse. He was negating his own conduct by affirmatively lying about what he did. And it certainly was material.
Well, did he affirmatively lie or he took the position he didn't recall? Or
his testimony was, "I don't remember." But Judge Bucklow found that every time he said, "I don't remember," that was a knowing untruth. He was selective about what he did not remember, and it was his attempt to derail the case because he did not want to testify.
What about the argument that Mr. Banker advances that we have an extraordinary case here because of the circumstances of his fear and the like?
Well, extraordinary cases are typically in the format of acceptance of responsibility coming after obstruction of justice. And in those extraordinary cases, the two can live in harmony. But in this case, we have simple obstruction occurring at trial.
Did he damage or did he just didn't aid the government? In other words, he didn't help build the case against others, but he certainly acknowledged his own involvement.
He did acknowledge, he acknowledged his involvement in driving the trailer prior to his arrest. His testimony actively impeded and damaged the trial of his co-defendants because he said, I don't remember, which could have led the jury to disbelieve or discredit his previous testimony. And as the district court found, it really could have affected the trial in this case. So the district court made a finding that his testimony could have acquitted guilty people. And that, of course, is the heart of the issue under determination by the jury, makes it absolutely material, and the district court's finding of all three elements of perjury support the obstruction of justice enhancement. And tied to that is then the safety valve, because, again, because he did not tell the truth, saying I don't remember was a false statement.
Yeah, but that was not part of his proffer to the government of the circumstances that he knew them. And the Ramuno case, which you rely on, indicates that in that case, the proffer itself was inaccurate. He says it contains the language in the final proffer interview. The defendant in that case denied certain things and he falsified them. Now, here there isn't any question the proffer was correct, is there?
That's correct, Your Honor. The problem in this case is that after the proffer...
Well, is there any difference then between the safety valve and the acceptance of responsibility? Is there any difference in the findings that have to be made with respect to one or the other?
Yes. The difference is that for the safety valve, he simply has to tell the truth about his conduct and the relevant conduct of the offense. And in this case, he did not tell the truth. He told the truth at one point, but then he actively lied about it later. And it's inconsistent with good faith cooperation to start lying.
Yeah, well, why is that any different from determining whether he accepted responsibility?
It is not unlike the situation where you have obstruction of justice and acceptance of responsibility. There may be extraordinary cases where one can obstruct justice and also accept responsibility, but that's an extraordinary case. And in this case, what we have is obstruction of justice, affirmative perjury occurring in the case of the offense, where he is negating his own conduct that occurred after his arrest by saying, I don't remember that meeting. He is negating what he did. And that should rightfully deny him the safety valve. It requires good faith cooperation.
Well, it's certainly true that there's a conflict among the circuits, or there's different interpretations by different circuits of what the safety valve requires. And some of them are quite clear that all that's required is an honest proffer. And if there's something that goes off the track later on, that's not relevant to the safety valve now. Whether that's the law in this circuit is what we're here to determine, I guess. But isn't that correct?
With respect to the Ninth Circuit opinion relied upon by...
Isn't there a Second Circuit one along the same line?
It's unclear to me whether the situations are similar in that, in this case, we have a finding of obstruction of justice. In the Ninth Circuit opinion, there is no indication in that opinion that the district court found that the defendant's trial testimony was obstruction. In the case before your honors, this is a case of obstruction. An affirmative finding that there was bad faith testimony being offered by a defendant. And in this court's case law on the safety valve, good faith cooperation is required. Now, he wasn't required to testify, but then he was called to testify, and he was sworn to tell the truth, and in bad faith, he lied. The district court was correct in denying him the safety valve, and similarly was correct.
You say the only difference between that and acceptance of responsibility is that there might be some extraordinary circumstances which would make a distinction between them. Is that You haven't cited what an example of that might be, but...
The difficulty may be in that usually a defendant can qualify for the safety valve and not accept responsibility because the defendant has put the government to trial. And the defendant can still qualify for the safety valve after trial and prior to sentencing. In this case, the defendant pled guilty and avoided trial, and so there was still an issue of whether he had accepted responsibility, but as the district court found, he did not accept responsibility. Because up until the very last moment of his sentencing, the district court found, he still had not come around and truly accepted what he had done because he was still flip-flopping and lying about threats or no threats, what he did, what he didn't do. For the reasons set forth in our brief, we would respectfully request that this court affirm the district court on all issues. Thank you.
Mr. Who? Lindell. All right. Mr. Cohn, you may have 1 minute and obviously 2 minutes for Mandela.
I asked a very simple question of the government. The thought that this card may cause there to be an issue of conflict, why didn't they bring and come and ask me about the card? Because, of course, the conflict and waiver of conflict is the right of the defendant, not of the counsel. They should have brought the notice of the card to me, and the problem of the card in its existence would have, of course, had a substantial effect on whether the jury thought there was commingling, therefore, as to whether those drug notes were in my client's wallet, and the government specifically said that. If you'll see page 25 of my brief, quoting from the prosecutor, it sort of lends support to the idea that things could have been mixed up by the agents at the time of the arrest. They should have told us about the card. Two, real simply, the prosecutor could not have questioned the defendant as follows if the interpreter had said broken the Spanish term used by the defendant meant things may not be properly functioning instead of broken down. And the prosecutor then could not have said, well, you know that's a lie, right? And well, you know the truck wasn't broken down, sir. But you already know, Mr. Gonzalez, the truck wasn't broken down, right? Couldn't have asked those strong questions of the defendant on direct, or the defendant appearing, at least in the eyes of the prosecutor, to be a liar, wouldn't appear that way if simply, as the prosecutor originally agreed, the judge would have come out and said, you know, the interpreter said the word really doesn't mean that it's not functional, but just something in it. That should have been corrected.
Thank you, Mr. Cohn. Mr. Mandel had 2 minutes. Mr. Matrick, you may have a minute also.
Your Honor.
If you may have a minute.
Thank you, the Honorable Court. Judge Flom, I think you asked the proper inquiry of my adversary. You asked him, why was that wallet probative? If it was, in fact, an ethical inquiry of me, then that should have laid the matter to rest, that there wasn't any conflict that existed. But the real issue is, and again, I believe you have, in fact, identified that issue, why, in fact, was that wallet probative? I suppose if something is probative, an item of evidence is probative, does it make that item more likely than not, or that fact more likely or not to have existed? To say it's just chain is an absurdity, because we would have stipulated if there was an issue of chain. There wasn't a matter of chain here. That wallet really doesn't make any fact more likely than not. It's not something that the government had to prove.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mandel?
With respect to the issues of sentencing, the safety valve and the minimum, the conflict in Judge Buchlow was whether the healthy skepticism she gave Perez's testimony was enough to indicate that my client Rodriguez was not telling the truth. The fact that she had this healthy skepticism should lead me to believe that she should have listened, looked at the evidence. There was no evidence other than Perez's testimony against Rodriguez. it led to her decisions regarding sentencing, which I think were very, very important, because it's clear from the evidence, from everything that was before, that his role was far less than anybody else in this matter.
Okay, thanks. All right, Mr. Banker, you used up your time, but you may have a minute also. I've been generous here. We want to get everyone.
Thank you, as far as the Romano case, it is distinguishable based on the fact that this Mr. Romano had continually lied and lied and lied during his proffers and did a lot of things here that the court found to be incredible. As far as the...
But you can't affirmatively get on the stand, even if you've been subpoenaed, and seek to weaken the case by obfuscating, as Judge Buckwell found Mr. Perez did here.
Well, Your Honor,
what's the difference between the outright lie and the kind of putting sludge in the system, if you will,
Well, the difference as far as the safety valve is concerned is that if you look at the Shreffer case, as far I know the court hasn't adopted it as law, but the analysis is effective because they make the distinction between what the safety valve statute's about and what acceptance of responsibility is about. And in quote, it says, rather, the safety valve was designed to allow the sentencing court to disregard the statutory minimum sentencing first-time nonviolent drug offenders who made a good faith effort to cooperate with the government. And in that case, he had done that at the very beginning when he...
But the good faith effort doesn't have a timeline that ends when the trial starts, does it, Mr. Banker? I mean, good faith is still a day of your sentence, isn't it?
Well,
you can't kind of discount it, can you, at a certain point give a 90% good faith, if there is such a concept?
Well, I think the distinction is going to be whether or not, again, I think it really goes back down to whether he perjured himself and what the court finds as far as that's concerned. Again, it goes back to that old question about the government creating...
Well, how do we get to that? If a district judge has made that finding, she's witnessed his testimony, and she's concluded he's perjured himself. How do we upset that?
Well, I think the court could look at again the standard as being clearly erroneous, and I think the court can look at the circumstances and look at the bigger picture as far as what's going on here. Here's the government compelling this witness to testify, knowing that he doesn't want to testify, that he's made that clear, and that he's scared, and then compelling him to do that in the trial of the co-defendant. I think, and you've got this whole problem, I think, as far as how is a defendant going to be assured that when he does proffer at safety valve, or beginning of the case. In this case, the defendant had said, I'm going to cooperate all the way through. But there are many cases in which they don't want to do that, and they wouldn't accept responsibility even, or they wouldn't agree to debrief under a safety valve if they knew that they were going to have to testify against the co-defendant.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Banker. Our thanks to all counsel. Case is